Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth, bringing on great guests, telling hard stories that may be more accurate than what you're getting in the corporate-controlled mainstream, covering all of the most important issues that are too taboo to take up at your mother's dinner table. Tonight, we're going to talk about one of the most important of the dubious terror events that have plagued our world in the last couple of decades, and that is the massacre on July 22nd, 2011, that is 7/22/2011, attributed to Anders Behring Breivik in Norway, but apparently perpetrated by professionals, as is usually the case in such instances. It's interesting that 22nd July 2011, once again we see multiples of 11, we see 22, we see 11. Reminds me of 11/22, the JFK assassination. Of course, 9/11. And then, of course, there was also, there was 7/7 in July. That didn't have any 11s in London. But it does seem that multiples of 11 show up way too often in these kinds of situations. But let's not go there right away. Let's go instead to my guest, Ole Damegaard. Ole Damegaard is a researcher on false flag terror and covert assassinations. Much of that violence is being perpetrated by essentially the same people all over the world, as he has discovered. And speaking of Ole's discoveries, he's come up with some very interesting new information about this attack in Norway, which massacred the entire generation, the new upcoming generation of the Norwegian Labour Party, which was moving towards an anti-Zionist platform that was being pushed by these very young people, were then exterminated in an act of political cultural genocide that will prevent Norway and has prevented Norway from continuing down its anti-Zionist path. Ask who benefits? It's pretty obvious. Let's find out what Ole thinks. Welcome, Ole Damegaard. What's up?
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's a real pleasure as usual.
Yes, this is a terror event that's extremely important. It stopped a major European country from continuing down the anti-Zionist path that it had begun. It eliminated this great bunch of young people who were helping turn their country towards justice for occupied Palestine. And it was such a huge crime as well. And yet, much of the world seems to have forgotten it. Remind us why it's so big and so important and why the world needs to pay attention.
For me, it's a great mystery why nobody's touching this one, because as far as I know, we're only a handful, like 1, 2, 3 people in total that is really digging into this. And what most people have forgotten is that this is the biggest slaughter done by one man officially since the Second World War. I mean, we're talking 69 victims on this island, Utøya, and 8 people killed outside the government building in Oslo. So it's an incredible massacre. But if it would be okay with you, I would just go quickly through the official story, and then we go into things that doesn't really match up.
Okay, so what's the official story of the biggest massacre committed in history by a lone nut?
The thing is that this Anders Behring Breivik, he was a 32-year-old Norwegian guy who was apparently very inspired by Timothy McVeigh. Because what he was very upset about multiculturalism, and he thought that the Norwegian Labour Party had sold out the country. So inspired by Timothy McVeigh, he constructed a 950-kilo fertilizer bomb, put it in a rental van, and just like in Oklahoma City, at least the official story of Oklahoma City, he went there, parked the car outside the government building, left the car, and then blew up the bomb with a remote control. I mean, that totally devastated the whole block around the government building, killing 8 people. And then he took another van, a smaller van. He drove about 1 hour northwest of Oslo, the capital of Norway, where he went to a small little island called Utøya. This island it's owned by the Labour Party in Norway. And there was more than 550 teenagers in a summer camp out there. He came dressed as a police officer. He identified himself as Martin Nilsen from the security police. And he said that he was there because of what had happened in Oslo, this terror attack, and he wanted to make sure that everybody was safe on the island. So he was taken over there by a little ferry. And once he was over there, without any warning, he suddenly started shooting people, execution style, with an automatic rifle and a handgun. And for more than 1 hour, he was left alone on the island, totally slaughtering people there, before the so-called Delta team finally arrived and arrested him. Now, that is the official story that is being pumped through media on a daily basis in Norway. Every single week, that's what you hear, that's what you hear, that's what you hear. The lone crazy guy in prison now doing all kinds of strange things. He's now recently said that he's going to starve himself to death. Or then it's about him wanting to go to university. And it's there's all of these stories all the time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and there have been all kinds of stories about him demanding like gourmet food and, you know, demanding really luxurious treatment in prison. And supposedly he is being treated pretty well. Of course, by American standards, every prison treats prisoners well.
But this is what we're being told through the media. I would put a very big question mark around the official story that we're being fed, because the official story, once you start looking into this, is absolutely not true. So if we can go to, if we do this in two chapters, first the government building and then Utøya, when you look at what happened at the government building, I try to come to a crime site with an open mind to see, okay, what happened? Does the evidence match up with the damages to buildings and the dead and so on? And what we see here is that it's totally not fitting. I mean, it said that the van was parked right outside the government building. But then when you have explosives that goes off, you always have the most damages closest to the dynamite or whatever is the bomb. Here we have a totally different pattern. We have the whole facade of a 15-story high building, the government building. All of the windows are blown out equally. Also, buildings behind the government building, they're just as damaged as the ones in front of it. So no protection from this building that was between them and where the so-called bomb is said to have been. They're just as damaged. All the windows have been blown in or actually sucked out. Because when you see the whole area around the government building, we're talking about some 500 meters from where this happened, loads and loads and loads of windows are destroyed. But instead of it being blown into the shops, the glass is sucked out. All the glass is out in the streets. All the debris is sucked out into the debris.
And well, this sounds just like Oklahoma City, where the car bomb outside was just the patsy for the real explosion inside.
Yeah, but here we're talking something different, because we're talking about hundreds of shop windows where there were no explosives inside. Also, it's very, very odd, because people who were very close to the center of the explosion heard no sound at all. Then people some 400-500 meters from the explosion, they felt a massive pressure wave, and there was like a 2-3 second delay before there was any sound, and then it came, the sound. But then that pressure wave, or whatever you call it, from an explosion, that could be felt like 25 kilometers away. And then they heard the sound like a thunderstorm, like a... So this is going totally against natural laws again. The sound should have been the loudest in the center, not way, way out there. And when you look also at, there's some surveillance cameras and so on in shops nearby, the shop doors are sucked out into the street and then slammed in, instead of they should have been blown in and so on. So it's totally the opposite of what we normally see. Also, there were some critics in the just like minutes after the explosion, when this started being pumped out in media, people were saying, okay, there's where the car is said to have been, because there was absolutely nothing left of the van where the bomb is said to have been in. Nothing. And some weapon experts said, it's very strange that there's no crater underneath it where the explosion took place. And then within an hour or so, suddenly there's this big crater appearing, almost clinically clean, cut out down into the garage. That appeared after there was a big fire vehicle that from the fire brigade that had been parked there. And then when that took off again, suddenly there was this crater.
The crater was not there at the site of the alleged car bomb, but it appeared because it was under where a fire truck had been parked, and when the fire truck drove away, they found it. Is that what I'm a little confused.
It is confusing because when you look at the very first images, it seems like there's no crater. Then a weapon expert in Sweden started criticizing, saying, wait a second, there's something very wrong here. This is when this vehicle got there, got parked, and when it left again, this big crater appeared, almost clinically cut out. That normally when you have a car bomb, for instance, if you go to Baghdad or war zones, you will see that when there is an explosion, everything is sort of like burned and black, and the edges are burned off. Here, it's almost like somebody knocked it out with some tools. It's totally white, clean, just very nicely cut out. So also where the car was parked, there was a ceiling, a roof coming out on top of it. But instead of that being blown upwards away from the bomb, it seems like one corner is almost like melted. It's concrete and it's melted. It looks like melted cheese that is just hanging down. And the more you look into this, it seems to me like what we're talking about is a different type of weapon technology than we normally see. Maybe something similar to what was used to dustify the buildings in 9/11 and so on. I do not know, but there's something very, very wrong here.
Okay, also, that sounds interesting.
There's an extreme lack of people in the area. The building seems to have been totally evacuated. The streets were shut off. And also, the streets in close by, some of the mainstream streets, when you talk to witnesses and so on, they say it was totally empty. It was like a war zone just minutes after the explosion. And when people came to the place, there were one guy who came running and he was filming while he approached the area. There's no one there, absolutely no one there. Then a woman appears in a uniform that has not been identified yet. Nobody knows who she was, but she looks very official with a walkie-talkie and a name tag. And she says, no filming allowed, go away, like this. But
very, very suspicious. So it sounds like there were fewer people in that part of town than there should have been?
Very much. I mean, we're talking, the official story is that hundreds up to 1,000 people ran away from the area. But when you look at the footage, there's zero people. And then after a minute or so, they start appearing. It's totally empty. It's totally evacuated. And there's one guy who rushes into the government building trying to save people. His friend is filming it while they run around. There's no one in there. They run around screaming, shouting, anyone needs help, anyone needs help. No one there, no one there, no one there.
Strange. So the hypothesis then is that the area had somehow been blocked off ahead of time. But if that's the case, wouldn't the people who would normally have been in that area know that? And wouldn't they talk about it? And wouldn't that make the whole operation impossible?
Very, very good question. And then again, if you look at 9/11, for instance, and other like Oklahoma City and so on, many people got like a phone call the day before saying, listen, I think you should stay home tomorrow. No explanation, just it's better you don't come there and so on. I don't know what happened in Norway. Please also remember that the people that should be in that building were working for the government. And here, the more we talk about this, I will show more and more evidence that the government was directly involved in this thing as well. So loyal to the government, loyal to the cause, I do not know. I can only say this is what happened.
Okay. So continuing with these anomalies.
I would suggest that what we might be looking at is an implosion instead of an explosion. So I don't know if you remember Fletcher Prouty, a man that I really admire. He was the guy a CIA whistleblower. He's the one portrayed by Donald Sutherland in the movie JFK.
Right, he's Mr. X, who points out that the military security for JFK was taken off the case and sent far away. He was sent to the pole, south or north or south pole, I forget which.
Exactly.
Right.
And Fletcher Prouty, he knew, I mean, he used to be in Black Ops and so on big time, but after JFK, he just thought, oh my God, the level of madness, I need to get out, and I will spend the rest of my life as a whistleblower exposing what's going on. And he said, please, when you look at these things, don't only focus on what happened, but what did not happen. And he said, it's the things that did not work that is clear signs of a black op. So let's have a look at what did not happen this day in Oslo. Well, okay. Unfortunately, the fire brigade that is just like 200 yards from where this whole thing happened, all five or six carports were blocked from the explosion, they say. So no vehicles could get out. So the fire brigade officer in charge, he had to run there on his own. So he ran there, no one else was there. Then unfortunately, there was only four or five police officers on duty. I mean, this is central Oslo in the late holiday, you know, late July, thousands of people in town, and there was only four or five officers on duty. Two of these were posted outside the US and the Israeli embassy. Now, unfortunately, the police alarm PC, the one that is the heart in the whole operation system in these kind of situation, that PC was turned off. And unfortunately, the internet didn't work either. And unfortunately,
shades of how the fire and police radios didn't work on 9/11, apparently because they were jammed.
I tell you, what I'm going to tell you is just the same for so many different operations. It's just like this one is extreme. So unfortunately, the police that came after this had to go to the area without weapons, because a few weeks before that, they had been called into to the main office saying, please give in your weapons, your bulletproof vest, all of these things. And they were locked into lockers. And the new rules were that two officers had to be there to open the lockers. And unfortunately, there was no two officers, so the police had to go without weapons. And unfortunately, the mobile network seemed to have been blown up, so to a big extent, it didn't work. And due to that, the different police groups had to communicate via fax. They were sending fax to each other to communicate during this whole thing.
Wow. So this sounds like a military operation here where they've planned to take out the communications of the police.
This is what standard procedure. They totally need to control all parameters, and especially communication. They need to be in total control of the version that gets out there. So everything is shut down normally, and then when everybody has gotten away, everybody that is involved in the operation is out of the way, then boom, suddenly it starts working again. And unfortunately, this day, the helicopter crew in Oslo had been given 4 weeks extra holiday to save money, it said. This crew would have been excellent because they could have found the guy in the rental car right away, because a witness had seen him. He was dressed in a police uniform with a helmet, with a glass mask, all of these things, and a gun when he left the first van and went into the second one. So this witness thought that was very odd and wrote down the number. So that could have helped to track him down. Unfortunately, when he rang in and gave this description and number and everything, it was put aside and it was only found later. But when you look at the helicopter crew, it said that they were given holiday to save money. But the year before, they had saved $22.7 million in unused funds. So to save money, I wouldn't say it was that obvious. Anyway, the night before this happened, our people in unidentified black uniforms were walking around in the government area. And also there was a drill that is always present, I would say, at these operations, was there. And the drill ended 22 minutes before the bomb went off.
Wow. 22 minutes, really?
That's 22 minutes.
You know, I hate to keep harping on this, but okay, I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry for 2011 Norway attacks. And if you look at the numbers that we see here, first, yeah, we see it happened in Norway on 22 July 2011. We've got multiples of 11 right there. The attacks claimed a total of 77 lives, another multiple of 11. It happened at 15:25:22 seconds in that time zone. And then it goes on and says the explosions in the building killed 8 people and injured at least 209. Well, 209 actually happens to be a multiple of 11. It's like every number they give us is practically a multiple of 11 in the first two paragraphs of the Wikipedia entry. Maybe that's a coincidence, but I don't know.
Well, I tell you, it was to start with, the official number of the dead were 86, and that was for 2 days. And then suddenly they changed it to 69 and then up to 77. And also it took 77 minutes before they closed the border to Sweden.
Really?
Exactly 77 minutes. So these numbers keep repeating. But when you look at what happened around this place, it's like you got the behind the government building and in front of the government building. Seems to be like almost two different areas. The one where behind the government building, it seems like there were real victims killed there. But in front of the building, you know, the building is separating these areas, where very obvious crisis actors appear. There's also one guy that is a very, I would say, he stands out as a military coordinator. He doesn't even look at where the bomb just exploded. He's just standing giving directions to different groups in the area. And you got different groups in camouflage uniforms. There's some military police, Norwegian police, that are there before anyone else, and they're there picking up a electric wire, some kind of electric wire, and they tell the film crew to just bugger off. They are also there are things with these uniforms that does not match up with the standard Norwegian ones. Also, you have... there's a lot of people in the area that have blue plastic gloves, anything from soldiers to people passing by to ambulance crews to people from the fire brigade to bystanders and so on. And I'm not sure why these gloves were needed, but I get a very clear feeling that these are that all of these are part of the same a group of people connected to the crisis actors. There's especially two women that became sort of the front cover, the cover girls of terror, the photos that were pumped out in media globally. One woman, her face is just one mask of blood, you know, there's blood everywhere. And the other woman has a 15 centimeter long wooden rod sticking out of her head. And if you look at the still photos, it looks absolutely horrendous, and these are the photos being pumped out there. But I managed to get hold of filmed sequences where you see what actually happened, and you see these people are being led up and down the street, crossing the street, going back and in front of the cameras, having taken these photos. There are 6 ambulances in the street, and they keep walking by them, and then in the end, I mean, I don't know about you, but if I had like a 15 centimeter thing sticking out of my brain, I would be somewhat concerned and say, I would sort of be asking, please, can you get me an ambulance? Can you get me to hospital? Anything like that. But here they walk up and down, up and down, up and down. The only thing, the woman with the blood in her face seems worried about is her hairdo. She keeps checking her hair is okay. And
it's always conceivable one could explain such things away, but we do see this pattern, and people have seen similar things with Boston and Sandy Hook in the U.S.
Yeah, it's standard. I'm just repeating things here. But what happens is that instead of getting into an ambulance and getting the hell off to the nearest hospital, they stop a bus. They stop a bus, and then they put all of these people that I claim are crisis actors, there are 5 of them, they get them into the bus, and then the bus is escorted by an ambulance. But it doesn't go to the hospital. Instead, it goes to a different place. It's called the doctor emergency type of thing. So I would say this is a very good way of getting crisis actors out of the area without normal people getting too close a look at the damages and so on. And the woman with the rod sticking out of her head, she was back at work 2 weeks after. The other woman had said that she had between 60 and 70 stitches. But when you look at her at the trial, just that was not long after this whole thing happened, her face looked perfectly fine.
Very, very odd. Yeah, and again, we saw some similar things with the Boston event, where some badly injured people seemingly were up and about doing things much too quickly afterward.
And then we have this thing with that always happens also, like there's these predictions, almost like trailers in films and news and sort of, and I've been told that the powers behind these atrocities are very aware of the law of karma. And the law of karma apparently says that if you tell your victim what is going to happen and they do not react, then the karma is on them. I don't know if that's true or not, but that is what I've been informed.
It doesn't sound sensible to me. I mean, come on. You know, it's so an attacker or a victimizer can simply announce what they're going to do and then it's okay.
But this is here, Kevin, where you see so many times before 9/11, for instance, there were so many signs in films and magazines and record covers predicting this, saying it, putting it right in front of us.
Yeah, remember that Coup album by the hip-hop group, The Coup? So it says The Coup, and there's the World Trade Center exploding.
Yeah, and he's got like a remote in his hand, and it's exploding exactly on the right floors and these things. But 6 years, 5 years before this happened, in September 2006, there was a newscast on national TV in Norway explaining exactly this thing. They're filming the exact spot where the car, where the rental van is said to have been standing 5 years later, exactly showing and talking about, we see that there's a risk here for a terror attack and the streets need to be shut off, exactly where they were shut off when this happened.
Wow.
And the whole thing is right there on national TV news.
You know, frankly, I don't see how that's going to help with anybody's karma, because no reasonable person would know just because there's a terror drill at a particular place that there's necessarily going to be an actual terror attack. So they're not really warning their victims. But there is something about there. They obviously do this repeatedly. I don't know if you've seen the clip taken from JFK's speech right before he was assassinated. I think he was at the Texas Mart, or wherever he gave his press conference. The announcer, right after Kennedy finishes his final speech, his final press conference, the announcer gives us this monologue about how easy it would be for a lone nut to assassinate the president. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have. There you go.
It's amazing.
And it's repeatedly. It's with all of these big events, it's pumping out there like a trailer to come to a theater near you. Do you know, like, I don't understand it. I'm just pointing it out.
I mean, you'd have to be a real coincidence theorist to think, you know, a crazy coincidence theorist to think that when the news announcer rambles on and on for no reason about how easy it would be for a lone nut to kill the president, and half an hour later, President Kennedy is killed, that there, you know, that's a coincidence? Come on, this is ridiculous. You know, and then these people say that we are mentally unbalanced for noticing these things.
But it's if it's only once, then I can say, okay, a coincidence. But when it starts building up and you see all of these cases I'm talking, I've been looked into hundreds, and they keep repeating again and again and again and again, then we're not talking theory anymore, I would say. Then we're talking like clear science of something else.
Right. We're seeing this as just somebody's MO, that some very, very powerful criminals who usually get away with their political violence have a kind of MO that they just keep using in each of their events.
Yeah. Okay, so if we move on to the island instead, the guy is said to have gone over there. The island, I've been there, it's a beautiful area. And the island is only like half a mile out. It's very close to the mainland. But the only way to get out there is with a ferry. It's a small ferry, a former military vessel. It can take one vehicle or 50 people. And it's armored, so perfect in a situation like this if you have to save people and so on. It said that he went out there. He was met up by the lady who was in charge on the island, because she had heard that the police was coming. So she went over with the ferry, met him, and went back. They then went up to the main building. There's only one main building on this. It's a small, small island. And he had a very heavy case with him that the captain of the ferry helped. He put it in his van and then drove up and parked behind the main building. Then the police officer went up to the building together with this woman, and then a security guard came and joined them. They stood and talked for a minute or two, and then suddenly this policeman pulls out a gun and kills them both, point blank, boom, boom. Now, the very first victim was actually the stepbrother of the Norwegian princess. He was working extra as a guard there. So, coincidence or not, but with one of the very first victims, there was a direct blow to the royal family. So I think it's worth noticing. Anyway, so for more than 1 hour, he, Anders Behring Breivik, is said to have been left alone, walking around on this island, shooting teenagers. I mean, they were panicking, they were screaming, they were running everywhere, hiding everywhere, and he was just let alone to walk around and kill them. He killed them, you know, in the buildings and the cliffs, in the water. Some people tried to swim away and so on. And at this time, I mean, it's only a few years ago, most teenagers had a mobile phone. So they tried to call the police, but unfortunately, the police didn't believe them. And they said, please, we've got plenty to do in Oslo. Please stop disturbing us. Also, they called again. I mean, there were hundreds of calls coming in to the police, but which is said to have blocked the police channels, the incoming lines, phone lines.
Now, were any police ever held responsible for their failure to respond, their false, you know, their claim that this was, they thought it was a practical joke? I mean, that sounds like dereliction of duty.
No one has been kept responsible for anything this day.
And that's absolutely another pattern, isn't it? All the people who supposedly screwed up worst on 9/11 were all promoted instead of fired and jailed.
There you
and we
go.
We see that over and over.
There you go. Also, some teenagers called, and then the police said, please, we don't believe you. Call your parents and let your parents call us. So the kids were calling the parents saying, please help us, help us. And the parents were then calling in, trying to get through. And the few that got through said that the person at the other end was very arrogant and just saying, you know, don't disturb us more or less and leave us alone. We'll take care of this and don't worry.
Wow. Now, you said that there were hundreds of teenagers on this island at the time. Is that right?
550, more than 550.
So there are more than 550 on the island of whom, what was it, 69 or whatever were killed. So there were a lot of witnesses who survived.
Yeah. So, but unfortunately, there were some police units in nearby cities that were there. As soon as they heard about this, they said, let's go, let's go, let's go. But they were told, stand down. There's no need for you to join.
Well, you know, that's amazing that you 500 people... and, you know, dozens are being killed over the course of an hour, and they've got their cell phones, and they're calling the police, they're calling their families, and nobody's taking this seriously? This is unbelievable.
I know. And then the police in one of these cities had a special car that was, specially armored, all of these things. But unfortunately, the car battery was dead this day, so they had to find jumper cables and another battery to get it going.
Just everything just happened to be going wrong that day.
Everything went wrong this day. But also, this ferry, the only way to get over there, except if you had a private boat, just when the shooting started, the head of the Labour Party, a young man by the name of Eskil Pedersen, he was in the main building, and young people, teenagers that tried to get into the building was met by a sign saying closed for unseen time, unseen future. Do you know, like, it's just going to be closed, so they couldn't get into
the closed house. Indefinitely. Yeah.
That's the one, closed indefinitely. So, but he was inside, there were some other people, and his story keeps changing, but more or less the story is that he was in there with the captain of the boat and some other people, his advisors and so, and they got a mobile phone call saying, "Get the hell out of there, take the ferry and leave." So there were nine people that ran down to the ferry and left the island. While they did this, there were teenagers swimming away from the island trying to save themselves, and this ferry just totally bypassed them and left them there to their own fate.
That's
Then,
either very despicable and cowardly, or it's worse.
now the ferry has about 600 yards to go straight across to the landing on the other side. But instead of going straight across, it suddenly goes straight north, 3.8 kilometers. That is, I don't know how many miles, but a lot. And then the ferry is rammed up on the shore so it can't be used.
Wow, yeah, so that would be like 5.5 kilometers, 5.5, maybe close to 6 kilometers. That's so instead of just going straight across the short way, it's going all over the place, sort of like the air defense on 9/11 that went out over the ocean and just waited there until it was all over.
There you go. This is what we're saying. Suddenly the ferry, the way to cross over to the island is eliminated. It's shut down. And unfortunately, the police, they had the special ops had a new system called Tetra, and the normal police had an old analog system that these two didn't communicate, so they couldn't speak to each other. And unfortunately, there were a police helicopter in Oslo with a sharpshooter that was on standby saying, "We're ready, we're ready, let's go, let's go." They got a direct order, "Stand down,
Wow.
stand down."
Probably straight from Dick Cheney.
I'm still trying to find out who gave that order, but it was a direct order to stand down. And why the guy
Wow.
was around, walking around on the island shooting these teenagers, I mean, we're talking kids from 14 to 17 years old, most of them. There was one police that had a sniper rifle on the mainland, and he had him in the crosshair, and he was online with the police headquarters, and he also got the direct order: stand down, do not fire.
Unbelievable.
And unfortunately,
And nobody's been held accountable for those giving those orders.
no. The Prime Minister, which we're going to get back to, he said that he takes full responsibility for everything. Okay, but unfortunately, also, a lot of the phone calls were diverted to the wrong police station due to a delay in one of the base stations of the phone system.
Interesting, right? Like the glitches we have here on Truth Jihad Radio occasionally.
Well, also, their military had Bell 720 helicopters from a special squadron, but unfortunately, all of them were without gas this day.
They just happened
So
to forget to put gas in their tanks.
I don't know about you, Barry, Karen, but don't you think no gas, fill it up and get out there? No, everything. They got in the air after this whole operation.
This sounds
But
even
thank God we had
lamer
the
than the
Delta
NORAD
teams.
excuses on 9/11. Very bad, very, very lame excuses. You would think they could script them more proficiently.
It was the same when MS Estonia went down. There were all these technical problems. There was no fuel for the helicopters. It was just delay, 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 while hundreds of people were drowning. This is
Right.
so cold, so cynical. Anyway, but now in on stage come the Delta teams. These are the guys that are specially trained, and they were the ones also that had a drill. And a drill, they had several drills, one of them more or less identical to the island scenario as well. Okay, so what did they do? There were five different teams, and they were really giving, full speed ahead out to the island. But when they came to the island in their special vehicle, instead of going down to the ferry landing, which is closest to the island, and see if they can maybe get a boat there, they went to a camping nearby. They went down to the camping and asked, "Where is the island? Where is the island?" People pointing it out, "It's over there." I mean, you can see it's so close. But instead of taking a boat, there were plenty of boats there, privately owned boats there. They went about 5 miles north. where they put in a rubber boat. And this rubber boat was not a very big one, and there were 11 in this Delta team. So all of these heavy armored guys with bulletproof things and helmets and all of these things, they took off in this rubber boat. They were all standing up. I mean, you can find this on YouTube. They stand up. It's like a Monty Python skit. They stand up, and this rubber boat goes out first towards the wrong island. Then they change direction. And then, due to the heavy weight, it starts taking in water, and the water kills the engine. So the rubber boat is drifting around with this super-duper-tuper troop of Delta warriors.
Who by coincidence, have just happened to drill this precise scenario of a shooter on an island.
There you go. That was 1 month before, but then they were using helicopters, you know, with the abseiling down and all of these high-tech things, and then the real event, boom, totally different. So, anyway, also on the way to the island, unfortunately, somebody blocked the send button on the radio, so the police radio was blocked, that channel was blocked, exactly like when they took out JFK, when one of the motorbike police officers did that exact thing. But while all of these things were happening, Anders Behring Breivik was walking around totally left alone to slaughter young kids. And while he was doing that, he was on his mobile not once but twice with the police headquarters. There were so many other people trying to phone in to the emergency number 112, but he managed to somehow get to another station where the one he spoke to was one of the people more or less in control of the Delta team. And he said, I've got it recorded, he said, hello, my name is Commander Anders Behring Breivik. In one of the phone calls, he said something more neutral, but in the second one he says, operation completed, is it okay to surrender now to Delta team? That is the exact word.
He didn't even bother to put that in code.
Delta team, and he wants to surrender. Okay, wow. And wow. The police answering very strangely and oddly, and you know, they start asking him, what phone are you calling from? And instead of saying, my God, what are you talking about? You know, or trying to persuade him to stop shooting. And then they say, unfortunately, they couldn't call back because the SIM card was locked. I don't know what that means, but I've spoken to keep people in the mobile industry. They say, or cell phone industry, they say they don't understand what they're on about. Anyway, after more than 1 hour of shooting, the Delta team finally arrives and they get to the island. And the commander of the group tells them to split into two groups, Delta groups, and they go from two different directions and encounter Anders Behring Breivik. So they shout out, and according to the first reports, they shout out his name, Anders Behring Breivik. In the official story now, they say, you know, freeze, that type of thing. Anyway, instead of a shootout or a violent or aggressive encounter, anything like that, Anders Behring Breivik very peacefully puts down the rifle, hands out to the side, goes down on his knee, and waits to be arrested. Now, the person that was they took photo of when he was arrested is quite a butch guy. He's quite muscular, blonde, thin hair, and so on, in a blue wetsuit with a police emblem on the side and a name tag around his police name tag around his neck. Now, the man that is photographed in the main building on the island being questioned, and who is Anders Behring Breivik, the same person who is now in court, he is there in a black wetsuit with a logo on his chest. And he's not at all as muscular at all, nowhere near. So I would suggest we're not even talking about the same person. And also, when you check the timeline, some 5 to 7 minutes after he was arrested, the shooting was still going on. Okay. Now, while this whole thing was going, was happening, there were no official helicopters in the air because there were 11 helicopters, but all of them told to go to another island and land over there. But there were unidentified black helicopters in the area the days before and during the operation. And when you listen to witnesses that were on the island and on the mainland, people were talking about multiple shooters. They were saying there were being shots fired all over the place from different areas of the island at the same time, indicating more than one shooter. There was a daughter of a police officer who was on the island. She said she called her dad and wanted to say, please come and help us. Instead, she got hold of one of the people connected to the Delta team, and she gave a very detailed description. She said there's four or five people in police uniforms here on the island, heavily armed. They're shooting at us and with automatic weapons, and they have also put explosives in the trees. There's other kids that came from the island that was talking about three shooters, two shooters, and also there was one man, he was identified without a uniform, but dark-haired. Also, the aerial footage of Breivik, there was one press helicopter that took some footage where you can see Breivik walking around with among the victims shooting. That guy shooting is a southpaw. He's a left-handed. Breivik is right-handed. And also the uniform he is on and the uniform that has been put forward as evidence is not the same uniform.
Hmm. Wow.
And is
there a place where people can see some of this stuff, actual images and so on? Do you have this posted or does anyone?
My website is lightonconspiracies.com, but you can just go to YouTube or Google Images, put in Oslo bombings and so on. It's so obvious when you look at it. It's just that it seems like I'm the only one more or less connecting the dots. And there's one Norwegian journalist called Hans Gorder and another one, anonymous guy called Jostemik. These are super researchers. Otherwise than that, I don't know. Nobody's looking at it at all.
And has any of this made it into the mainstream press in Norway?
Absolutely not.
Wow.
Not. Absolutely not. It's totally quiet. I was warned to go to Oslo. You know, I was there one time. I gave a speak about the political assassinations and false flag operations. There were people from the PST, that's the security police there. And the next day, I wanted to go to the island. I went there, out there with this this journalist friend of mine. And while we were standing there, I mean, it's out in the middle of absolute nowhere. There was no people at all. And we were standing waiting at this ferry landing where this infamous ferry comes. Instead, suddenly a rubber boat came full speed and out of it jumped two police officers that ran over to us and demanded for us to identify ourselves. And once they identified us, he went away for a minute or two speaking on the radio. He came back, stood right in front of me, said, "Ole Damegård, a decision has been taken. You are not welcome here. You have the choice to leave on your own or you will be arrested. Danish and Norwegian police have nothing on you, but opinions like yours are not welcome in this area."
And is this public property?
It's totally. It's like, and my friend, he's really cool. He was just like, "But why do we have to identify ourselves? I mean, we're standing here. It's a public space. It's like right in the middle of nowhere. We just want to take the ferry. Why do we even have to identify ourselves?" And the police got quite aggressive with him, not physical, but verbally. And then he said afterwards that, "But now that when you know our names, maybe what's your name?" The police just refused to answer. And my friend said, "But do you mind if I take a photo of the two of us?" So he went up to take sort of like a selfie, and the police just backed off. And then he said, which I think is a total Freudian slip, he said, "The only thing I can give you is my service number, Delta 031. That was the number that the police officer gave us, Delta 031. And I'm not used to police officers giving their service numbers other than a series of the letters and numbers, but Delta 031. And later I found out that the guy who approached us like this, He was actually the second in command in the Delta team that was on that island that day. He is the guy, according to what he said in at the trial. He is the one that put the handcuffs on Anders Behring Breivik on the island. So it was a very strange experience to stand there and look into the eyes of someone that I believe was part of the operation itself.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And after that, I received a subtle, but what I believe is a death threat, saying that there are killer teams above the Delta team that work in the light and dark, and I would be very, very careful to name Delta members if I was not totally sure. You know, we're talking about big, big things here. This is not a Norwegian operation. This is something totally different, I would suggest.
Right. Well, we had some information at Veterans Today that it was partly run through a Freemasonic network in the Norwegian police services. And I think haven't you discovered some Freemasonic connections?
Oh, they keep popping up everywhere. And one of the things I recently discovered when I was there is that, you know, after these assassinations and false flags, and so very often they erect an obelisk, almost like a business card, or giving the rest of us the finger, like a secret sign to their own members, but somewhere in the near vicinity of where it happened, or very well used pyramid shaped thing that keeps repeating itself. And here at the Utvika camping, there's this beautiful little monument with a sculpture of a man and a woman sitting hugging, trying to comfort each other. And just behind that is a pyramid shaped rock, and the whole monument is on a pyramid shaped little lawn, and in every single corner of this pyramid shaped lawn is a pyramid shaped rock. So it's not very subtle.
They might as well put eyes at the in the tops of the pyramids,
but it's hidden in plain sight. It's right in front of your eyes and you don't see it.
Wow.
But also, you know, like unfortunately the pathologist couldn't count, because the death number went from 100 down to 86, down to 69, down to 77. And some of the parents of these dead children, when they received their kids, three of these parents were told that the child had drowned, but when they opened the coffin, there were bullet holes in the bodies.
Jeez.
And also, quite a few of the parents have not, still to this very day, received the autopsy reports. Neither have they received the mobile phones that their kid had, because, I mean, there could be photos of whoever was doing it or anything like that.
Now, have there been any survivors groups? It was, of course, survivors groups of 9/11 that protested and ended up forcing the creation of the 9/11 Commission. And one would think that people who lost their kids in this kind of an operation might, at least in some cases, have the courage to stand up and demand some answers.
As far as I know, zero. I'm not totally sure about that, but absolute zero. And when I went there, my intention was, even though I was being threatened, I thought the more reason to go there, because this needs to get out there. I mean, the traumas, the sorrow, it's incredible, the level of it all. And especially for the family. So I thought when I got there that families would be in the audience. Absolutely no one. No one. So the plan the second time I went there was to do one talk and then one day in between so that people could spread the info, and then another talk on the third day so that it would have been, so the people and family members and friends and so on would have the time and so to get there. And when I did the second talk, there was even fewer than the first time. It is the official story, nothing else. It is just like a secondary conspiracy of silence.
Well, that's interesting. It's also a little bit puzzling because, you know, sometimes, you know, we often do have survivors and people, you know, related to victims in these kinds of situations who do stand up and protest. Usually it's a minority, but there usually are a few. And it sounds like this is very unusually unanimous in terms of the way that everybody is covering it up. I mean, is there even a Norway, you know, sort of a truth movement around this besides you and, you know, as you mentioned, two other journalists?
No, as far as I know, no.
That's crazy.
That's it. And we're talking about it's a world record in mass slaughter by one guy. I mean, this should be like a mini 9/11, I think. And no one is touching it.
And it's also just so obvious that this, you know, the beneficiaries here include the hardline Zionists who took out a whole building anti-Zionist movement in Norway by massacring the people who were spearheading it. And then, of course, you also have the way that a European nationalist was blamed for it. And, of course, the European nationalists, to some extent, are opposed to this EU New World Order agenda of knocking out national sovereignty. So they blame, you know, people that they can demonize. It's not really that subtle. It's obvious who gains from these things. And yet nobody is even allowed to think about who gained from crimes like this. Well, it seems to me we need a kind of a...
Exactly. Yeah,
go ahead. I think you're cutting out.
I would just like to make a little more about why it was done.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes, so we need the short version.
Okay, I just want to point out that it said that he used the same bomb as Timothy McVeigh, the exact same weapons as Timothy McVeigh, but also that the manifesto that he wrote, it's a total copy and paste from the Unabomber. It's what's at its base changed. And his lawyer, it seems like, or it turns out that he and Anders Behring Breivik were using the same lunchroom. They had companies in the same building, and that building I tracked down is the former or current headquarters for the Norwegian Stay Behind movement.
In other words, Operation Gladio in Norway.
Operation Gladio in Norway. Now, I would very much say that Jens Stoltenberg, the prime minister at that time, extremely central in this operation, a Bilderberger. His father, Thorvald Stoltenberg, Bilderberger. And in the morning, when this whole thing happened, for 4 or 5 hours in the morning, the former Bilderberger and the former Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, was there together with these youngsters and left just about an hour before the shooting started. Now, the one, if you remember Eskil Pedersen, the one that left with the ferry and rammed it up on shore, according to what I found out, he is the illegitimate son of Jens Stoltenberg, I would say a future Bilderberger, and also somebody who's been raised to the skies in this whole aftermath. Instead of being totally criticized for leaving these youngsters to die on their own, you know. And Gro Harlem Brundtland is the architect, together with Maurice Strong, of Agenda 21, a big, big player in this whole thing.
So it's the usual suspects.
It's the usual suspects.
It's just pretty much what we would have expected.
And just 1 week before, or 1 week after this happened, Norway was just about to pull out of the bombings of Libya and Afghanistan, the NATO bombings. And had they gone, as far as I've been informed, had they left, then Denmark would have followed and the whole NATO operation would have been endangered. So just like dear Obama says, from time to time, we just need to twist the arms of countries that don't do what we want them to.
So once again, as we see so often, NATO and Israel are the big winners in a terror event, massacring Europeans. We saw it with Charlie Hebdo, and we saw it again here in Norway with this 2011 Norway event. Well, thank you so much, Ole Damegaard. We're at the end of the hour, but it's always great checking in with you. You're one of the leading researchers of these crucially important topics. So God bless you and keep up the great work.
Can I just say, Ken, that after this happened, Jens Stoltenberg was appointed head of NATO.
Well, that was his promotion, his reward, I guess. All right. Well, thank you, Ole. Your website's lightonconspiracies.com. And I look forward to our next conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.